History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they really don't have to go untold, as long as some of us are willing to ask a few questions and then to listen patiently as memories that could have been buried for decades take on new life in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today's episode was recorded in a beautiful city of a little less than 1,500 people that's known as the birthplace of Montana. There is some fascinating history to explore in Fort Benton, Montana, and if you ever make it out this way, you really ought to track down Durrell Gibbs, a real Montana cowboy who survived the Battle of Okinawa during World War II and had one unforgettable incident within that battle come full circle with a special element of closure decades after the war. We're going to get to all of that, but as always, it's best if we begin at the beginning.
I spent the first 7 years of my life in Portage, Utah. Portage is just 17 miles south of Malad, Idaho, so the border between Utah and Idaho. That's where I spent the first 7 years of my life, and it was great there at Portage. Everybody, they milked their cows out in the corral, and when they got through milking cows, they'd open the gate and the cows would go out on the street. And now this is in the early 30s. Depression was on. Two-thirds of the kids in town, it seemed like, had a desert Mustang for saddle horse. We'd start at the top of the town every morning, and as we come down through the town, why, we'd gather all the cows up that was along the streets, and we'd take them down on the Malad River. There was a community pasture there. We'd take those cows down to that pasture about a mile, and at night we'd gather the cows up, drive them back up to town, and the cows pretty well knew where their place was, so I guess that's where I got the fondness of working cows and horseback.
So how old were you when you were doing that?
Oh, I had to be probably 5. I hadn't started school yet. There was a fellow in town that was manager for the Ogden State Bank sheep herd. He'd hire the herders, of course. There was no jobs available. My dad was a camp tender, and they was down on the Nevada desert. And there was lots of Mustangs down there. So anytime they caught a Mustang, and they'd bring him up, and some kid in town would have a saddle horse. We didn't have saddles, of course. We rode bareback, but it was a great way to grow up. Everybody was the same, and no sugar, or they didn't have money enough to buy sugar, and everything was a community affair. In the fall, if you had pigs to butcher, well, everybody in town that had a pig to butcher got their hogs butchered, and it was just that way of laying food away. Kind of comical. I don't remember, but they tell me enough so that I feel like I remember it. My dad and mother had a discussion about going down to see my dad's sister. It was 25 miles is all. But in the 30s, the Depression was on. My dad said, oh, we don't have enough gas in the car to drive down to Lena's. So I went out and I got the hose and I stuck it in the gas tank and filled it up. And I went in and told my dad and mom, I said, your tank's full. I filled it up with the garden hose. So, and you know what that was. So there, that's just one of the many incidents that I grew up with.
Well, I've got a lot of questions after that. I mean, first of all, a lot of people listening, they hear you say Mustang, and they're just thinking about the car. I mean, Ford has kind of taken over proprietary rights on that name. But you're talking about wild horses that you guys would get a hold of. And a lot of five-year-olds imagine themselves becoming cowboys. They dream about being a cowboy. But what you're saying is you were a bareback cowboy herding cows at age five.
Well, yeah, for the town, I mean, everybody had 2, 3, 4, 5 milk cows, and we just go out in the, they didn't go put them in a barn and have milkers. We'd just go out with a stool and sit down, and we'd milk the cow just out in the corral. When the cows would haul milk, everybody just opened the gate and let the cows go in the street. We'd gather the cows.
And I've got to ask you, too, and I know you kept riding horses till you were 90 years old. You've spent a lot of your life on horseback, but as that five-year-old riding a Mustang, were there some misadventures? Did you end up on the ground a few times?
Oh, yes. But then that was just part of growing up. I mean, we it was no big deal. Everything was community involved. Looking back, those were great times. A lot of people didn't have sugar, couldn't afford the sugar. But everyone was the same, you know? So it seems like maybe when times are the toughest, that's you remember back, and those were good memories.
And when you were 7, you moved to Idaho?
Yeah. My dad was the youngest one in the family, and my Uncle Cy was the oldest. My dad's father died at an early age, and my Uncle Cy had to take over. He had to look after the family. My Uncle Cy was elected mayor of Portage. He was mayor for 27 years. So it was great. And it is great right today to go up to the Portage Cemetery, and I think I'm related to everybody in that cemetery. So, in looking back, those were great carefree days. I compare that to some kids that grew up on the street. Thank goodness, I just thank the Lord, but nobody had any money, and I started school in Portage, and we moved to Idaho. My dad would work in the sugar company factory in the fall up at in Idaho at Blackfoot. My dad moved up there, and he worked on a farm, run a farm for a fellow that was an official in the sugar company. So that's how we got to Blackfoot. That's where I grew up. After that, I graduated out of high school there.
Do you remember at a young age having an idea in your mind, hey, when I grow up, this is the kind of life I'm going to have, or who I'm going to be, what I'm going to do?
Well, I always liked to be around animals. Cows. Yeah, all those years as I was growing up, I just, well, always had a saddle horse. I enjoyed riding and working with a horse. So I guess you could say that. I was always aware of how people helped each other, their outlook toward people. I just grew up as a common kid, I guess. And the older I got, the more I wanted to have a cattle ranch.
And I know it's a good thing you ended up moving to Blackfoot because you might not have met your wife otherwise. But, you know, what about those high school years? Did you have any inclination that war was coming before it showed up?
Let's see. It seems like I was in my sophomore year when the Japanese hit Pearl Harbor. And all of that, you know, how a country is, all of a sudden they're in war. And it was amazing to see what our country I think back of the 40s and the 50s, and I feel bad because I think our generation and the generation right behind us fell down on responsibilities, because today, how many kids in our country know that you cannot find anything older on a vehicle, 43, 44, 45, those 3 years, there's no vehicles on the road. No combines was built. Everything went to the war effort. And with that kind of a pull, we was fighting a war on two fronts, and we won because everybody was working together. And when I compare that today, it's unbelievable. So my favorite time when I look at my country and everything, I say how united we was, and then today how divided. It's scary.
Well, and the spark for all of that, the thing that brought so many people together, was the surprise attack, and you just made reference to it, December 7th, 1941. Seems like everybody has a pretty specific memory. who was alive that day. Where were you? What were you doing? And how'd you find out?
Well, I guess we went to school that morning, and that was the topic. They hit us on Sunday, well, Monday morning, and, you know, it was a total surprise to the nation. We didn't know Japan was ready to do something like that, so it was a total surprise. And that morning we went to school, man, that was the topic at school. Of course, then as I went to the next few years at school, there was people enlisting and going to the fight. And, you know, there would be the women would go build ships, be welders and everything. And it was a wonderful experience to see how the country was pulling. And then here, by the time I graduated out of school, I knew I didn't have a chance to enlist. They were waiting for me. And right out of school, just a few months, you know how the chain of command has to work. It takes some months. I went to the Army and done my basic training in Camp Hood, Texas. They call it Fort Hood now, but that was Camp Hood. As soon as that basic was done, I was on my way to the Pacific.
And I want to talk to you about that, but I'm curious about something else, too. So you're in high school. Pearl Harbor's bombed. You said it wasn't too long. Guys started signing up. But another thing happened. A few months after Pearl Harbor, President Roosevelt issued an executive order that basically made Japanese Americans on the West Coast, whether they were citizens or not, made them enemies of the state. They were classified 4C enemy alien and weren't allowed to serve in the military. And then they got sent away from the coast because that seemed like a risk and sent to these internment camps. And you said there was a camp not too far from where you were, where some Japanese were sent?
Oh, yes. I'd go by that camp every day, and I wasn't aware at the time of the stress they must have felt of being uprooted. It isn't unreal to think that they could have been sending messages, or, you know, to their country. Let's turn it around. Say the U.S. had hit Japan, and there was lots of U.S. citizens in Japan. What would Japan have done? But these internment camps, I was never in one, but they could do their things every day, but they had to leave their businesses and that, and it was no doubt a hardship. But we all was working for the betterment of the country.
You know, you mentioned going to Camp Hood for basic training. Was that a piece of cake for you, or were there any moments that were kind of, hey, this isn't necessarily going to be easy?
I was slow in growing up. I grew up more after I got in the Army than I did for the several years before I went to the service. And yes, it was a challenge for me on those forced marches and stuff like that. I was on the smaller soldiers there. I was one of the smallest ones. I found that's where I had to pay a lot of attention to detail because like on a forced march, it'd be at night, and we'd be marching maybe 15, 20 miles with a full field pack and a rifle, and we would march for 50 minutes, and then we'd fall out for 10. That takes up an hour, and then we'd do that just regular. Well, I found out that when we fell out after marching 50 minutes on that 10-minute reprieve, I found out that if I laid in the bar pit with my head downhill and my feet up, I laid there for 10 minutes, and when I fell back in to start the march, that's what kept me going, because that laying down with my head downhill and my feet up, I could gain that 10 minutes. It gained me time.
Was there any particular aspect of the training you received that in hindsight you say, you know, that was really helpful and that paid some dividends when I actually ended up in combat?
Oh, yeah. I had a buddy. There were several of us, like in bayonet training, you know. Howard Keller, he and I had talked back and forth about that bayonet training. We had both agreed. I said, man, I don't know why we are doing all this. I said, if it come down to bayonets, I'd throw my gun at them and I'd outrun them to the ocean. And we both figured, well, that's what we do. But you had to go through the training. Howard, his last name was Keller. My being Gibbs, why, a lot of times when you're split up, they take what your last, like G's, all the G's would come over here, K's would be over there. So when we shipped out, when we went overseas, why, we got in different outfits that way. But we was in the same division. He was in another company, and there was a time when we was all at night, you'd dig in foxholes, and that was the way you spent the night. That was protocol. Well, the Japanese had come up, snuck in really close, and just as the crack of dawn, jumped in there and hollering banzai, and it was bayonets. And I looked over there, and Howard, here, there was a Japanese soldier running toward Howard, and instead of throwing his gun and racing to the ocean, Howard is running to meet the Japanese soldier. And the rifles, you know, in what they taught, and the Japanese rifle went sailing up there, and that was it. So that sticks in my mind how that's what we's going to do. Your training takes over. I asked Howard afterward, I said, what was you thinking about? And he said, Darrell, he said, my mind just, I wasn't thinking about nothing. He said that everything he done was what training took over.
And the courage is summoned in a moment like that. You mentioned, you know, heading overseas, and I'm curious about that. Had you ever been on a ship before?
No, but here's all these guys from all different walks of life, and we're all doing the same thing. You just fall in a pattern. No, I'd never been on a ship before, and it was funny. We laugh at anything. The first time over, and the roughest time, is when you're getting the ground swells closer to the land. The further out the ocean you get, there's sometimes it can be just as smooth and nice. But the ground swells, you get out 4 or 5 hours, it's pretty rough. And I tell about how everybody is seasick and throwing up. And so you're on the decks, out there on those steel decks. When you're like that, it don't matter whether the sun's up or down or what, you're sick. And the sailors, those guys, boy, they got a remedy for that. They just turned the hoses on, quite a bit of pressure, and they'd wash down the decks, and you'd be right out there. They'd wash you down, you know. So you was glad to see it coming. It didn't matter if that's just the way it was. People don't stop to think about things like that, and all of a sudden, you're there.
It's time for our first break, but when we come back, we'll find out what Durrell Gibbs experienced once he made it overseas, fighting in the Battle of Okinawa with the 96th Infantry Division. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and a short video with this 97-year-old Montana cowboy, and Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 97-year-old Durrell Gibbs of Fort Benton, Montana, a survivor of the Battle of Okinawa with the 96th Infantry Division's 381st Regiment, I Company to be exact. When we left off, Private Gibbs was heading overseas, and I'm always curious what the true expectations are in situations like this. You remember having any thoughts or questions maybe about whether or not you'd make it home from this war?
No, I don't remember even thinking about that. There was so much going on, many incidents, little incidents that happened to, maybe didn't happen to the guy next to me, but they happened to me or and vice versa. You know, like one time I remember it was kind of rough and it was a little nicer being out on the deck than it was down the hole. We'd have six men, our bunks, you'd climb, go up the bunks. It was just a pipe. Canvas would be laced in there and you'd slide in sideways to your bunk. And the guy in front of you would be about a foot. You had a foot of clearance and you was about a foot below you, there'd be another guy. There was, I don't know, five or six. Well, you don't spend too much time on your bunk. It's a lot better up on the deck and the breeze is blowing. So they had some barrels, 55-gallon drums, laced there by the side, and I felt a little tired, and I didn't want to go down to my bunk. So I just laid on, there's half a dozen or so barrels there, and I just laid on top of those barrels and dozed off. In the meantime, the ship got pretty rough, and there was nothing kept me would keep me from rolling off the barrels. If I rolled one way, I'd hit the deck, and if I rolled the other way, I'd drop off the ship. And here I napped for, an hour or so. And when I woke up, that ship was really rocking, and I looked right over my, right there. Nothing kept me from rolling that way, and I'd have dropped off the ship. Just little things like that stay with you. But I didn't think about anything. I didn't worry about a fight or, you know, or what would happen when, I don't recall thinking about it until it was there.
Until you got to Okinawa, and, you know, people that know the timeline know Okinawa was the last major battle in the Pacific. But did you all have an idea of how the war was going? Did you think it was getting close to the end, or was that not even a thought in your mind?
Oh, no. The way it worked, when Okinawa fell, at the end of the fight in Okinawa, the division moved to an island in the Philippines, Mindoro. We knew then, when we went to Mindoro, there you get all the strength built back up, and we'd do our regular calisthenics, all our practice. We would use old tanks from airplanes that had been crashed and wrecked, and we'd fix a shower and stuff. We had all that kind of stuff there that we just put together ourselves. And while the division was getting back to strength, and then word come down that the LSTs, the ships were there, and we was about 15 miles from the ocean. So the equipment was all loaded, and then we were going to load the next morning early to hit Japan. And the 96th was slated to be one of the divisions to hit Japan right off. The next morning, we was with our bunks, you know, was just folding cots, and there was 12 men to a tent, a big tent. And we struck those tents that night and folded them up and loaded them on trucks. We just slept out that night. Next morning, we was going to make that march to the ocean and load the ships and was going to hit Japan. That next morning, we got up early. The news had come down that the Japanese had surrendered. So the tents come back, and until they seen what we was going to do, the 96th Infantry Division was not a regular division. It was a division that was put up after Pearl Harbor. So it was going to be, I guess, the 96th would be, everybody'd go home and there wouldn't be a 96th division anymore. And news come down, they come down with a program where if you wanted to sign up in the regular army, they called us Red Apple Boys, for regular Army. If you wanted to sign up for that Red Apple program for 1 year, and I did. I signed up for 1 year. They sent us home on an extended furlough. I thought maybe a month or something like that. Then I reported back to Seattle. It was always out of Seattle. And I went back to Okinawa with with military government. And I was in the public health department. And I was listed as a typist in the office there. It just so happened that the colonel was a surgeon, and he had seen combat. And I was about the only one there that had seen combat. And he seen my record, and I told him, I said, Colonel O'Brien, an Irishman, I told him, I said, hell, I can't write my name on a typewriter. And he laughed. And so I wound up with, I was in charge of all the alcohol that we were setting up medical dispensaries for the civilians, for the people, the doctors and stuff. And I was in charge of seeing that they had all the alcohol, whatever alcohol they needed. And I had two interpreters and a Jeep. And I kept that Jeep just like it was my own vehicle. And that's how I spent my last year in Okinawa, right back where I seen it tore apart. And then it was part of the program that put it back together.
Well, and I've got a lot of questions about some of what you shared, but I don't want to get lost time-wise and neglect to come back to the actual battle for Okinawa. Had you ever heard of Okinawa before you got there? Did you know what you guys were getting into?
No. Mm-mm. We were just there. The division was there, and I come in whenever your manpower gets down, you know, they keep the division as up to speed, so to speak, with the manpower. That's when I joined when I was sent into the 96th Infantry Division on Okinawa.
Tell me what you remember about that, your first experiences coming ashore, what they had you do, where they had you go. Take us back there if you can.
Well, the division was already on Okinawa, but when we come to Okinawa, when we got there, it was dark. And they have a big, heavy rope. It's like a mat, only, you know, they throws it over the edge of the ship. You go down that like it's, I don't know hardly how to describe it, like a web, you know. Yeah. And you can either climb up it or go down it. Well, and they had these landing craft would pull up right again the side of the ship, and we'd go down that and get into that landing craft. That landing craft was up and down probably 4 or 5 feet, you know, up and down with the waves of the ocean. And steel helmets, and there'd be one guy climbing or going down. It was just like ants going. It was just all so new and kind of exciting. And you was just doing what a lot of other guys around you was doing. So, and then the landing craft would go in and the front end would drop down. They'd go in with the landing craft until it hit the sand, you know, the bottom. And probably when you got out, you'd be in water up from your knees maybe somewhere to your waist. You'd just get in there and find whatever protection you know, for cover. And it was usually, if I remember right, it was probably 12 men to a squad. You had that sergeant, he would give you any directions. He would give the orders. He was the 12 men. We formed in those squads and in those big tents when we were building up strength on Mindoro. Everything was first, second, or third squad. And that's how you got your orders and kept order.
So on Okinawa, again, so much of this is new to you. What was your first real taste of combat or what this new thing was going to be like?
Well, you know, real foliage was real heavy on Okinawa. But there was so much shelling going on. By the time Okinawa, the Air Force had complete control of the air. The only Jap planes we seen was, what do they call them, when they fly them into a ship and try to sink the ship, kamikaze. And those were the only Jap planes we seen. But the big guns, we just hear those shells coming, and you got so that you could, the first, you'd hear a high-pitched squeak, just a high-pitched whine. And the closer that shell got to you, the higher that pitch got. One night I was, and this was happened kind of soon, we hadn't went too far. We was pushing in, and who knows what you're going to run into until you get there. And the sniper fire, so one minute you'd hear some shots and you'd be under sniper fire. And then pretty quick, that wouldn't be there anymore, and you'd try to move out and get, we're taking a hill. It seems like we was always fighting for a hill, for the high ground. And you never knew, you could hear the shots, you didn't know where they was coming from, and you'd get up sooner, and if you seen a Jap, you tried to shoot him just like he was trying to shoot you. And that way, you was either gaining ground, or if you couldn't gain ground, you dug in. Every night, we dug a foxhole wherever we was at, and of course, everything was in order. We dug the foxhole, and that's how we'd spend the night. And of course, the size of the foxhole depended on how hard it was to dig. But we tried to get 3 feet. We would try to get 3 feet. Sometimes it'd be two, and you wouldn't dig it any bigger. There's always two men to a foxhole. It depended on how hard it was and how far you dug. But one of the experiences I had, I mean, you just took everything as it come. You was there fighting, and that's the way it was. And you remember incidents, you know, and that's what I remember. That's what I'm telling now. There was an incident where I was digging the foxhole. I had that radio that kept us in contact with the company, and I didn't have any radio experience. It was just everybody done what they had to do under the circumstances. And it was a walkie-talkie deal. And that darn radio, you know, you had to push, and then you could talk, and then you let up, and they could respond. Mm-hmm. And that's what kept us hooked up with the company. And so I happened to fall heir to the radio one time, because if a radio man got shot, man, whoever was closest to that radio, we had to get that radio. Sure. And that darn radio had a 3-foot antenna, so nobody wanted it, but somebody had to have it.
And you didn't want it because a 3-foot antenna is pretty noticeable and makes you a bigger target?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so I had that darn radio, and the radio man had to be right with the sergeant that was head of the squad, and because he would relay messages back and forth from the company. Command was back a little ways behind the lines. That darn radio was just, I was right there by the sergeant all the time, and he was a go-getter. We wound up getting awarded the Bronze Star, and it must have been for the fight. I mean, you never knew. You just took every day as it come. I don't know what specific action generated that Bronze Star.
Were you starting to tell me about something with the radio? Did you end up with a close call because you had the radio? Is that where you were going with that?
Oh, well, yeah. We were dug in for the night, and this is what started all this stuff about me even being on TV, or we were dug in for the night, and I was busy. Sergeant had some duties he had to take care of, so I was there digging the hole, and I heard this big shell coming, that high-pitched whistle, kind of a whine, and man, it just got stronger and stronger, and you know, by the seconds, it comes right fast. Boy, I laid flat in that hole. I had it about half dug. That landed, maybe 40 feet. That shell landed 40 feet from me. 40 feet isn't very far, and made a pretty good-sized cone-shaped hole in their terrain. It kind of, I was half in and I was kind of half out of consciousness, and in digging that hole, I'd taken off my gear, like those heavy web belts that you hang grenades from and everything. I had taken that off and laid it on the edge of the hole. And of course, when that got so loud, I was right down in the bottom of that hole. That landed, and when I kind of got my senses back, I don't know how long that took, but I went to reach over and get my canteen, and everything I touched on that heavy web gear, I just touch it. It looked from normal. Just look. I'd touch it, and or I'd go to pick a little, and it had just turned into powder. Yet all the hardware and everything, it didn't blow it away. The concussion just turned into powder. And that night, there was two men to a hole, and one man was always awake all night. We would take turns. I'd be watching for 2 hours, listening, and be at the ready. And the other guy would lay down in the bottom of the hole best he could, because I was wrapped around his feet. And I'd done my watch, and I was trying to get a little shut-eye. And the sergeant was standing there doing his watch, and all of a sudden, I was just being walked on, and I was hearing him grunt, and a Jap soldier had crawled up, and it was a hand-to-hand situation.
And we know he lived to tell the story, but that story has taken on new meaning in this century for 97-year-old Durrell Gibbs. When we come back, you'll hear what he took away from that encounter, and eventually we'll hear about the incredible connection that would lead to decades later. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328. 28.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 97-year-old Durrell Gibbs of Fort Benton, Montana. After World War II, he fulfilled his dream of becoming a cattle rancher as he and his wife Lucille raised their three kids in central Montana. We heard how he was rounding up cattle on horseback as a five-year-old, and he continued riding horses till he was 90. But so many of those memories never would have materialized if he didn't survive some intense moments of hand-to-hand combat on Okinawa. When an enemy soldier dropped into his foxhole in the middle of the night. I don't want you to share anything you're not comfortable sharing with regard to how you made it out of that hand-to-hand situation, and the Japanese soldier did not. But can you pick up things where we left off? You and Sergeant Frank Dowell were in that foxhole when the enemy surprised you.
I come up out of that hole. Well, there was two of us, and it was pretty dark night. That Jap, he died right there. It laid him off the side of the hole, and we spent the rest of the night. The next morning, real early, we was going to move out, and I seen that Jap soldier had a pistol, So I wanted, it was always for souvenirs. So I wanted to get that pistol. While I was taking that pistol off of him, he had a wallet up here on his jacket or whatever they call them, in a pocket. And that wallet was really protected. It had a heavy cloth and cut fancy. That wallet surprised me. And so I was getting a pistol. I just put that wallet in my pocket and we was moving out and I never thought any more about it.
And we're going to come back to the story of the wallet and what a story that is. But I'm trying to put myself in your shoes. So you're in a foxhole and all of a sudden there's an enemy soldier in there. What prepares you for a moment like that? How do you respond? How do you know what to do?
You don't know. You just respond. There's where the training comes in. You just, there's nothing to be, you can't plan anything. You just react. There's nothing planned. I don't know how else to put it. Well, I'm sure that training has, you know, in part of that training, they'd have you dig a hole, and then we dig another hole to fill the first hole. And what does that do? That prepares you, no matter what the orders is, no matter what you're asked to do, you do them.
And that wasn't the only close call you had over there. I think I read in the great book that your son Wes has put together about a couple others, and there was even a phrase, divine intervention, thrown along there. What are some of those close calls you remember?
The closest call was probably what resulted in an accident about the grenade. We were dug in for the night. The terrain, there was this, I call it a ravine, a coulee up here in Montana. We call them coulees, that led up into where we was dug in, and the Japanese soldiers was trying to crawl up and get in so that at daylight they could have these banzai attacks. And we dug a hole kind of out in front that overlooked that ravine. And at night, the only thing you can do is we stacked up several cases of grenades. Me and another fellow was in that foxhole that night, and we would toss a grenade. We give them enough time that if we thought that they'd be crawling up there, we'd throw a grenade out down there, and maybe we'd throw one and wait a minute and then throw another different time so that there was no set pattern. We'd take turns. We were standing right shoulder to shoulder. It was Charlie's turn to throw a grenade, and we just opened a new box of grenades. In order, it seemed, I could be a little off here, but the grenades we were used to had like a 6 or an 8 minute fuse, 8 seconds fuse. And so that was close quarters. Ordinarily, when you throw a grenade, the way it's, you got a long handle there, you grip the grenade, you pull the pin, and you throw it. And when you throw it, that handle flies off and that starts the fuse burning. Well, if it's a 6 or an 8, whatever, there's just a little trail of sparks you can see. Like at night, if you throw that grenade, you can see that grenade going through the air with those little sparks. Well, in order, a lot of times, if they're real close, hell, they could grab that grenade and throw it back, you know. So we, under those kind of conditions, we would pull the pin, let that handle fly off, and then the fuse was burning. Then we'd bring it up here and throw it. And by the time it got out there, and it would explode, that we cut the time bound in half.
So they wouldn't have time to pick it up before it exploded and throw it back on you.
Yeah. So we just opened a new box of grenades. It just happened to be Charlie's turn to throw the grenade. And he pulled the pin, let the handle fly off, and brought it up here to throw it. And he hesitated just a minute because there was no sparks coming. And he hesitated just a minute. I just opened my mouth to say, you better get rid of that, Charlie. But at the time I opened my mouth, that grenade went off right here. And I was right there.
So it went off right outside his right ear, and you're sitting shoulder to shoulder to him on the other side of him.
Yeah, standing shoulder to shoulder. And now if it had been out here, it had got us both. But it was right there, and it didn't kill him. It didn't, probably blew, it had to blow his arm off, and the concussion of it and everything, it just kind of stunned me for a minute to have that grenade go off within 2 feet of me, but he was right here next to his head, so he was shielding me. I don't know how come they heard behind us something, I don't know how come, but right out of the clear, right out of the night, it was in the night, here come three guys to see what happened right soon. Charlie, I was hanging on to him, and he was still on his feet, but I was trying to keep him on his feet, and it was just probably just a few seconds, but, you know, time, how do you know under conditions like that? But here they come, three guys, and they got him out. I was trying to keep him up so we could get out of the hole. It was dark. I couldn't see anything about him. I can't understand why he just didn't die, just be dead right there, because that grenade went off right next to his head. The three of them was able to keep him to his feet and got him back, and I had to stay there in that damn hole. And the next morning, his helmet was laying right over there, and I picked up his helmet, and here's a grenade breaks up in little square pieces, the way it's ground, and they're sharp. And I picked up his helmet, and here's, that steel is heavy, a good heavy steel. Here's four holes, four square holes in his helmet. And I pulled the liner out, the helmet liner, and here's two holes. And here's two square fragments embedded in that helmet liner, but two went clear through and onto his head. And I to this day, I don't know how he stayed on his feet. Well, I kept him. How was I able to even keep him on his feet? Well, that was just, and that was pretty close. What if I'd have been throwing the grenade? I'd have done like he did, but I wouldn't have hesitated. But then the grenade would have went off out there and got us both. If it had been out far enough away from him so that I got the fragments too, I'd have got it too. But
so it's a matter of time, and it's a matter of distance. And I think there was another story where you got up at just the right time, so a sniper bullet that landed in the hole you just left didn't get you?
Well, I didn't see that, but a fellow that was on my right flank, he said, "Darrell, I was crouched down in an old shell hole. I wasn't behind any timber or any growth or anything. I didn't feel, I knew I didn't have the right cover. And so just like in my brain says, I got to get out of, I got to get better cover." And snipers, every few minutes there'd be the sniper fire. And I jumped up and made a dash for some brush where I'd have better cover. Afterward, that kid that was on my right, he said, "Darrell," he said, "it's a good thing you jumped when you did," because he said, "just as you jumped," he said, "a bullet kicked up, a sniper bullet kicked up dirt right where you'd been." And he said, "you just got up, bang that." I heard the shots, but I didn't know where they was coming from or anything. And it was those kind of things happened several times that just made me sure that the Lord had something more that I was supposed to do. Happenstance, handle, you know, you can lay it to happenstance. It's just the way the luck was. But eventually, when it just keeps on, eventually you got to think there's more to it than just that. One other time during the monsoon rains, it just pours down day and night. If we're out on the line and in a hole, we spend our time in that hole. We was in there 3 days and nothing ever moved. It was in the mud and the water. And we had grenade boxes and two men to the hole, and we'd take turns of sitting on that grenade box. Night and day, we would take turns of sitting on that grenade box. And when the water in the hole got up We had the combat boots, and you know, when it got up so it was over the top of the combat boots, about halfway to your knee, we'd take our steel, pull the helmet liner out of the steel helmet, and we'd bail that water out of the hole until it got down to where ankle deep. About every half hour, I'd sit on the box for a half hour, and then he'd sit on the box, and we took turns day and night. After we'd been in there for a couple of days, one time he said, "Oh, Darrell," he said, "my foot just feels like it's on fire." He was sitting on the box, and he raised his foot up like that, brought his foot up out of the water, pulled it up out of the mud and water, and it only took a minute, and steam was just coming out of that boot. Just steam, like he was holding it over a fire. I seen what he said. And what he had was a trench foot on that. And I never seen him again, but I'm sure they probably had to amputate, you know. Why did I was there and witnessed all that? Why didn't it happen to me? And there's all these incidents that happened through the thing. Happened to somebody else, but I was there to see it. Mm-hmm. Why?
And maybe the answer to that question of why will come into clearer focus next time on Hometown Heroes. If Durrell Gibbs hadn't survived all those close calls on Okinawa, his three children would have never been born, not to mention the grandkids and great-grandkids. There are quite a few belt buckles that would have gone to other cowboys in competition over the years because he wouldn't have been there to win them. And the biggest reason you need to catch the rest of his story next time, there is a family in Japan who would not have been reunited with that fallen soldier's wallet full of photographs. How that all came about is a saga we're going to need a whole nother episode to capture, so don't miss next time. And remember, you can find photos and video with Mr. Gibbs online right now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. I'm Paul Effler, hoping you can join us again next time when we'll be reminded again, like we were today, that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.